You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up on Saturday, the latest edition of the Arizona Biennial opens at the Tucson Museum of Art. The Biennial got started in 1948 and is the longest-running juried exhibition that features only Arizona artists. There are 50 pieces in the exhibition, representing the work of 33 artists. Julie Sasse is the chief curator at the Tucson Museum of Art. She's also curator of modern and contemporary art, and she joins us from the studios of Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Julie, why is the Arizona Biennial so significant in the realm of Arizona art?
It has this long tradition that makes it very important in terms of the continuity of the arts in Arizona, but it also provides an opportunity for people to see some of the new emerging artists that are coming out and also some of the well-known artists that one doesn't normally get to see in an exhibition setting. So it's wonderful for many different reasons, from the emerging to the well-known.
What kinds of art will people see at the Biennial? I imagine it's a whole variety, but can you break it down for us?
Well, first and foremost, it is a contemporary art exhibition. Every biennial, I select a juror, and it's usually a well-known curator whose work I've been following, watching their exhibitions to see that we're being looked at by curators that perhaps can then scout and use some of these artists in other contexts. So in this particular case, we have Irene Hoffman, who's the director and chief curator at Site Santa Fe, and she's done some amazing exhibitions. So she came out from Santa Fe and worked for several days. We looked at about 500 artists and over 1,500 works to make the final selections of 33 artists.
I'm sure people will wonder why the guest curator wouldn't be from Arizona. Is there, especially when we think about Arizona art, why do you think it's significant to have a guest curator from outside the area?
Well, it's kind of funny. I've polled a lot of the artists, and I said, would you like me to do it? And they said, no, we want fresh eyes. We know you know our work. So they actually like the exposure. It's also a way to have curators look at different contexts instead of the normal way that we're used to seeing the artists. So, for instance, emerging artists who've never shown before, young grad students, people where there's no history with the known curators in this area, they have a chance to be exposed to these curators because they have no familiarity with them. So there's no preconceived notions or understanding. They look strictly at the work that's been submitted. In this particular case, what made it very special is that Irene Hoffman is very interested in concepts and ideas and thought-provoking work. So we have lots of installations and videos and work that has something to say beyond just the pure visual.
Can expectations be less obvious when it comes to contemporary art? Is the feeling that when someone goes into a contemporary art exhibit or something expansive like Arizona Biennial, it is not predictable in any sense of what they might see or the way the art might be displayed?
Well, one of the things that I find really exciting about this particular biennial is that the artists are very cognizant of what has gone on before them and the rich history of Arizona or the West. So they aren't throwing away the past and just focusing on the future. They're embracing the past as they make statements about the realities of being in the Southwest or being in the West today. So, for instance, we're looking at work that includes palladium prints on old rusted cans. We're looking at someone who's found a diffused bomb and powder-coated it with candy-colored paints. They're looking at things in new ways. At the same time, they are very well-educated and very cognizant of everyone who's come before them and how they build on that art legacy.
We think about the fact that these are Arizona artists, and people have certain perceptions of what Arizona or Arizona art would be. Is it important that people sort of fit into that and think to themselves, I have this perspective of what I think Arizona is, regardless of what outsiders may think?
Actually, it's interesting. The idea of fitting into a stereotype, if anything, if they address the idea of stereotypes, it's to critique those stereotypes. Mm. But what I found is that very often the same themes come out biennial to biennial, and Irene Hoffman pointed it out, and that is that some of the artists focus on nature and humankind's impact on nature. And of course, to do that in our area, it addresses the desert and water issues. It certainly addresses urbanization. She also found one of the categories that sort of emerged after the fact was the idea of reclamation. And that was the idea of using desert detritus, everything from, like I mentioned, the rusted cans to old newspapers, recycled things with a sense of repurposedness about it. And then she noticed that there were a lot of works that were being submitted that dealt with the culture of violence, the idea of our gun culture or the commodification of violence, and very current topics. I mean, right off the front pages were being addressed in some of the works, and you'll see some of that in the exhibition. And then the idea of the surveillance society. One artist in particular, Dennis Gillingwater, has been working with that kind of topic for years, and time again he gets selected by the curators because they find his work so compelling.
When someone visits the Arizona Biennial and sees the art that you've described, which sounds so thought-provoking, what do you want people to feel or think when they leave?
I think what I would like to see people come away with is that art doesn't have to be just about pretty pictures, but it doesn't have to be just what people are calling political art, where they're afraid that it's going to be very didactic and preachy. I think you can come away thinking and feeling responding. And again, it comes back to the museum's mission, which is connecting art to life. And I think almost every piece in the exhibition does that in very profound ways.
How impactful do you think this particular biennial can be compared to others in the past?
I really think this one is more conceptual than some in the past. There's certainly fewer artists. Irene definitely wanted to curate this right down to the layout of the show. It meant a lot to her. And I appreciated that she took that extra time. I think she was very invested in the process. She, in a way, selected like she selects for Site Santa Fe. She didn't think of those stereotypes like this is what they will probably want. It was more about how does the work measure up to what's happening with the rest of the country.
Julie, there have been perspectives, whether correct or not, there are opinions that the Phoenix area in particular might struggle a little bit as it relates to accepting or embracing contemporary art as a city that is somewhat traditional and also has many people from other parts of the country that may bring their sensibilities to this area. Does Tucson have that as well? Is that something that someone involved in contemporary art may say, well, that's a stereotype that doesn't apply now, perhaps never applied?
It's interesting. I've been working on a lot of research on the history of Arizona art and how it evolved from purely a Western base to the contemporary art that predominates right now. And, of course, that was a big struggle. A lot of people wanted to see it stay Western because that seemed like it belonged here. Well, we're a global society now. We're well attuned to what's happening everywhere, and it affects us as well. I think Tucson can handle it. I think it depends on what audience you're trying to secure. We have one of the biggest art communities around. People come here because they hear it's a very strong community of musicians and poets and writers and artists. And they don't play to an audience. They do what they do. And I think that's what makes Tucson so special is that it's not necessarily a tourist market for the work. It's a wonderful mix of like-minded people who feel a certain sense of freedom to create what they do.
Julie Sasse is chief curator and curator of modern and contemporary art at the Tucson Museum of Art. We've been talking about the Arizona Biennial, which opens on July 25th. That's this coming Saturday. Julie, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We've had a few technical difficulties. We've changed the lineup around a little bit, but right now with me is Tom Riley, who's the director of the Morrison Institute. Thanks to a majority of state lawmakers and Governor Doug Ducey, Arizona has adopted a position that gives it the toughest welfare policy in the nation. Arizona is now the only state that will limit the lifetime eligibility requirements for families who receive temporary assistance for needy families or TANF support for 1 year. The federal government allows up to 5 years of support before it gets cut off, and the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU issued a report earlier this summer titled TANF Cuts, Is Arizona Short-Sighted in Its Dwindling Support for Poor Families? So, Tom Riley, you're part of co-writing this report. Give us some background. People have probably heard the acronym TANF, but When did it get started and why did it get started?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So TANF stands for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And that program replaced the old program called AFDC, Aid for Families with Dependent Children, in 1996. If many individuals recall, President Clinton passed this in a bipartisan manner to end poverty and welfare as we've known it. And the most important elements of that restructuring, one was that it moved the program from the federal government to the state government. Two, it imposed strict work requirements or training for job training. And three, it set that lifetime limits on the number of years a recipient could receive federal funds, some exceptions for individuals with disabilities. And it set that at 5 years. But it gave states a lot of flexibility. So TANF was designed with two explicit functions. One is to help poor adults with children, and I want to emphasize the with children because it's not for single adults, move into the labor force. And two is to provide a safety net for families when they cannot work.
So you have some interesting charts along with the report that indicates a lot of the money has moved from, again, working families or trying to help people get back in the workforce to child care issues. Our Department of Child Safety has been certainly a mess in many ways in Arizona, and states, particularly Arizona, are moving money toward that. What are some of the problems with that, Thomas? You see it based on what TANF was created.
Well, I think we looked at the program since its inception in 1996 and 1998 to the present, and we see two major trends that have kind of characterized the program since its inception in Arizona. One is that a gradual decline in benefits and time limits over the years. So they've moved from the 5 years down to 1 year now, and they've also decreased the monthly amount that individuals can receive, as well as a gradual shifting of those funds to other areas that divert from its original focus. So TANF basically comprised of three major areas. One is cash assistance to individual families, job training and job preparation, and child care. And if we look at the program since inception in 1998 here, about 90% of those funds went towards those original activities. If we look at the budget currently, it's about 30%. What's interesting that if we look at 1998, how much was spent for child welfare, and that's traditionally Child Protective Services, foster care, and adoption, is around 6%. And that's close to 65% now. So what's occurred is that not only we've decreased the amount to phase out the program for poor families, we've shifted those funds to child welfare.
So in lieu of finding other money for child welfare, instead it's in essence kind of a sweep. It's from one side to another. And that's obviously created some complications in and of itself. So can you posit the theory, Tom, that as we think about a lot of the increase in the number of neglect cases reported, perhaps at Department of Child Safety, can any of that be associated with the fact that you don't have parents who are able to get the workforce training to perhaps get out and work, so there are more issues that are compounded that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at during the past decade, Arizona's had the greatest increase in the nation in child removals. And by a wide margin, the largest percent change in number of kids entering foster care. And it's those neglect cases that have made up the staggering increase in child removals. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, clearly is that Arizona statute requires that a removal of a child is, we have to find malfeasance and neglect. It's hard when, you know, families are struggling. And given that our surge is in those neglect cases, you know, these programs aren't, you know, independent. They're all interdependent. And if we look at the monthly, I mean, what a family can, in order for them to qualify for a TANF, is that, you know, we're using the 1992 federal poverty guidelines, and a family has to earn not more than 36%, which is about $5,000 a year. So we're not talking about a very generous program.
Yeah.
So when we have individuals and families that are struggling, you know, particularly with children, and workers go out there and look at these neglect cases, and there's nowhere else to place the children, I think this is, you know, a great reason why we're seeing such a surge. So when you impact one program, and on the surface it may sound like, well, we need the program in child welfare, let's move it over to the Department of Child Safety, not having those resources placed to social workers in a very challenging position.
So the actions by Arizona lawmakers and the governor, in essence, accounts for about $6 million based on the report in a $9.1 billion budget. So Why do you think TANF is not getting any love here?
Well, I mean, I think that is puzzling because, I mean, you couldn't argue that it's a great savings. You know, moving it down to 1 year, you know, when you talk about the original intent, it was actually prepare to move them out of poverty into the workforce. And that takes time, many time, to do job training and have the child care in order for the individuals to receive the training. 1 year is a pretty tight limit. And as you pointed out earlier, there's no other state that has that restrictive of a requirement. But also when you look at, and you look at it in tandem to the child welfare problem that we're facing in Nevada and the large number of families removing and having limited resources that families have who are in poverty, it's hard not to say there's not a connection. So I think, there, you know, there's policy trade-offs. There's look at where we, the term we want to use our funds. We would argue is that you need to look at them together because they're interdependent.
And Arizona's had a habit recently of cutting back on these sorts of offerings. Is there anything deeper there? Sure, Arizona gets pigeonholed as a conservative state, but there's got to be something beyond that. If it's the only state to have gone with 1 year, is there a feeling that there are other programs, other ways they can do it better, or is TANF simply not liked?
Well, you know, a family who's in poverty, you know, there are other type of programs. That doesn't mean a family is not eligible for SNAP or the food stamps or for Medicaid and some of the other health programs. But if we look how this particular policy was passed, it was kind of lumped together in a budget and there wasn't any public hearings on it. So I don't know that legislators and the public had, you know, adequate opportunity to debate and discuss the implications of this policy change. It was just kind of rolled up in a budget and passed, and there was no discussion on it. So I think it's why this TANF program hasn't been discussed before, is that, you know, many individuals just found out after the fact. You know, again, I think that when we look at policies, particularly since there's such great emphasis on child welfare, you have to look at what other support systems are out there. And, you know, if we're seeing this incredible surge in number of children being removed because of neglect and issues of poverty, you know, we'd probably need to look at what type of resources are available to keep children together in their homes.
Tom, not to be too much of a downer here, but what is the worst case scenario? Because we can say, all right, short term, there are people who are involved and will only get TANF for a year in Arizona. But if we think about a year and then a year and then a year, many, many people who are limited by this situation and find themselves in a really tough situation to be able to find work or better their lives in some way, where it's not, these are not people who are not looking for things and don't want to improve themselves. Could this have a very negative effect, you think, on Arizona? Could this create, some people are very concerned about the so-called income inequality. Could that create a wider gap?
It could. I mean, I think there's, you know, if we look at the number of programs that are available to individuals and poor families, they've been dwindling. So, again, from a policymaking standpoint, I think that we have to look at all the type of resources and how one program can impact another. And I think, again, on the surface, people are saying, well, you know, clearly looking at the problems that the Department of Child Safety has faced over the years and our problem with child welfare and the large number of kids, that, you know, it makes sense to use this federal money for it. And we're again emphasizes that, but we're taking away from the same families that many of the individuals are working with.
Tom Riley is director of the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. We've been talking about the report called TANF Cuts, as Arizona short-sighted in its dwindling support for poor families. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Right. And just one more note. You can find that on our website if people are interested in looking at the report.
And the website is?
Morrison Institute at ASU.edu.
Tom Riley, thanks.
Thanks.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Arizona State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt about his criticism of Governor Doug Ducey's education funding plan, as well as what it is to be the treasurer of Arizona. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Goodwill of Central Arizona, where your donations helped place more than 44,000 Arizonans in jobs last year. Learn more about how your Goodwill is working at goodwillaz.org.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Not much going on in Valley traffic right now, but if you're out and about, maybe taking an early lunch, running some errands, be advised on the southbound Loop 101 freeway in the West Valley. We're seeing a report of some potholes in the roadway at Peoria Avenue, so you want to exercise some caution right there. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, sunny skies, 92 degrees in Tucson. It's sunny in 93 in Casa Grande, 82 degrees right now in Prescott. Prescott. Sunny and 93 in Flagstaff. Sunny skies 95 right now in Yuma. Well, there are many ways to support KJZZ, including vehicle donation. You can donate any used car, SUV, motorcycle, or even a boat. Car donations help us bring you the news you need, and you get free towing and a tax deduction. To donate your vehicle, go to cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. 15% relative humidity right now in the valley. It's mostly sunny and 96 degrees in Phoenix at 11:28.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Governor Doug Ducey broached an idea recently for increasing the funding that goes to Arizona's K-12 public schools. The governor proposed raising the amount of money that comes from the state land trust. Ducey says the plan would bring $1.8 billion to schools over the next 5 years. That proposal was heavily criticized by Democratic state lawmakers who said it wouldn't do nearly enough for schools. But recently, State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt also said he had concerns. And the treasurer joins me now. Treasurer, at long last, nice to speak with you. How are you?
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
So give us an idea of your concerns with what the governor's broached out there.
Well, the governor's proposal, for those who don't know, it calls for to increase the distribution from the endowment trust from the current 2.5% to four times as much, up to 10% of the net asset value, not of earnings, but the net asset value, for 5 years, and then take it to a 5% distribution for five additional years. So the proposal violates the prudent investor rule. It does not protect the trust from inflation. And most importantly, it dips into the corpus or the principal of the fund. And so if you think about this fund, it's the important thing to remember is it's not a savings account. It's not a bank account. It's not an investment account. It's a trust fund set up for intergenerational equity in perpetuity. So this money is meant to be around. It's been around for over 100 years. It's not new money at all. It's been here for 100 years. It's meant to be here forever to help support the education of Arizona's children. And to go out and spend huge amounts of the principal now will have consequences for future children. So basically, those children in elementary school now or younger are going to see a $1 billion drop-off in funding in the year 2022 before they even reach high school. And I just don't think that's a wise decision to make, a very short-sighted decision to have this big upfront distribution that leaves us in a big hole later.
Now, the governor has argued that at the end of this proposal, the state will actually still be in pretty good shape because we're actually, as the trust grows, we're not actually knocking down too much of what's going on. Perhaps it'll be a little bit lower than the current level we have right now, but at some point, we'll actually be able to even this out. Are you concerned that the state might run into difficulty, or we may start relying on this trust too much in a way we shouldn't be?
Well, there's no question about that. Once you teach lawmakers that they can bust the trust, good luck protecting any of it in the future. The point is, this has been attempted before. It was attempted actually a different kind of a way, but a raid on the trust was attempted in 2008 by then Governor Napolitano, and Treasurer Dean Martin stopped that. So it's happened in the past, and thankfully no one's been successful in doing so. But yeah, absolutely. When you have a big pot of money, it's a hard thing to not go after and to grab.
Is there an alternative that comes to mind for you? I know you're not an education expert, but you are a financial expert in many ways. Is there some other plan you think? Because most people, even if they're not on board with how the money should be spent, most people think Arizona schools don't spend enough.
You know, and the main thing to think about with this fund is this isn't the main funding source for education. Mm-hmm. Now, this fund can absolutely pay more. It's done very well in the markets. We could take up distributions from this fund by 50% safely and still protect the future. And I'm all for doing so. But keep in mind, the main funding source for education comes from the legislature, comes from the budget. This is not part of the budget. This is not part of that process. This is just a supplemental source. So even if this fund was paying out $1 billion a year, it wouldn't relieve the legislature's obligation to still fund education through the normal way.
Now, the governor, before he was governor, was state treasurer. Do you think he perhaps saw the numbers or saw the system a little bit differently than you? Because one would think he would have a pretty good idea of what the land trust is supposed to do.
Well, yeah, there's no question. He's seeing it differently than how I see it. But, you know, also opposing this plan are our treasurers, Dean Martin, Carol Springer, and Tony West. So many former treasurers before the governor also opposed the plan. So But he is the first treasurer that I know of to support something like this. Keep in mind that when he was treasurer in the 2012 changes that happened in the trust, he supported pretty much the opposite, which was to keep the distribution as low as possible.
Do you think the state can and should be working to sell more land to get more money in the trust? And if, in fact, there was more money in the trust, would you be more willing to go along with this plan?
Well, yes, we need to sell more land. I think there are easy ways to do so. And the good news is we have a new commissioner there that seems to, I think that's one of her goals. Lisa Atkins just got appointed as commissioner. She's very well respected. She's very sharp. And so I think we will see, naturally, just more land sales. But it doesn't matter how much money is in this trust. So there are similar trusts set up through the Enabling Act. And, you know, New Mexico has, I believe, $19 billion in theirs. Texas has $25 billion in theirs. If we raid this trust now, we'll never get to those levels. But if you think about if we were to get to those levels, get to a $19 billion, a $25 billion trust, what that could do for our school children, and we're on the path to get there. And so I don't want to take it. And I forgot to address something you said a minute ago, which is, you know, one of the talking points of the proponents of this plan is, well, we'll have more money in 10 years, and so it doesn't matter. But here's what I say to you. It's the equivalent to, Steve, if I go to you and I say, hey, Steve, you've got $100 there. I'm going to take $40 from you. But here's the great thing. You don't need this $40 because the $60 I'm leaving you, if you reinvest that over the next 10 years, you're going to have $102. You're going to have more money, $2 more than you have right now. So you're not going to miss this $40 I'm taking to you. Does that make sense to you? Do you think, oh, yeah, you're right, you could have this $40? Or do you go, but if I keep all 100 and I invest that, I'm going to have $142. So why wouldn't I do that? It's a really weird argument. And also to keep in mind, this particular pot of money is not the state's money to do this with. This is already owned by the schools. And so in essence, you're giving money to the schools and telling them it's new money, but it's already their money. So the whole plan to me just doesn't make any sense. If we're going to increase the funding in education, we just need to get down to the Capitol and get everyone in a room and figure that out. But to do a raid on the trust fund, which is meant to be here in perpetuity, that's not the correct way to get it done.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Arizona's State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt. A few minutes left in our conversation. And Jeff, I want to go to a little bit of your background, because you've got this experience as an investor. What are the differences now to you that you've seen being an elected official as opposed to being a private businessman? What are some of the major differences you've seen?
You know, I think in the way that people problem solve, in similar to this, I think one of the surprising things to me is with elected officials, in many cases, people come up with an idea and they, in a closed room without any input, and they get really sold on their own idea, and then they take it out to the world and they don't want any input. And there are a lot of smart minds down here and ways to make it better. And in the business world, we get everyone together. We all get in a big room. We all throw out ideas and we all have input, and we leave the room with a cohesive plan that we call a win-win, say. There are ways to change this plan and make it a win-win for everybody, where the schools can get more money, but we also don't destroy the corpus of the trust. And I really want to get that done. I think we need to get everyone in the room, bring in Republicans, Democrats, and beneficiaries, and everyone, and let's work out a better plan. There are better ways to get this done. That's, I think, the thing for me coming from the business world is we just do things so much differently, where we come out of a room and we have really much better plans than doing it by the current method. I think that's the biggest change I see from the private sector to the bureaucracy of the Capitol.
Now, I imagine as a businessman, you are not someone who, when you'd get your tax bill, you were overly thrilled. And I think that's one of the things when you talk about Republicans and Democrats getting together. A lot of people feel like without the governor's plan, at some point, inevitably, taxes will have to be raised. And many, frankly, elected officials don't want to even approach that, even at a temporary level. What are your thoughts on that? Not that necessarily you're advocating a tax increase. I wouldn't expect you to. But is there actually an alternative plan out there other than short-term tax increases?
Well, that's where I don't want to step on the toes of the legislature, because that's their job. That's what they do. They apportion money from the budget. Now, there are ways to get more money without tax increases, and one of the big things that I've been trying to do is just finding the inefficiencies down here. We have over 100 different agencies, and so many of them are doing duplicitous roles that we can save money. I have already found many ways down at the Capitol we can save money, and we need to do that. And every dollar we save can go right to schools. So the first thing we do, we can save tens of millions, if not more, in a lot of different things down here. But the legislature has to get together, and they have to figure out, you know, what portion of the budget goes where. And that's going to be their job to do. You know, I don't want to overstep my role, but my role as treasurer is to be the guardian of the money. And my role, and that's one of the reasons that the treasurer is independently elected. So I can be an independent voice in protecting the money and looking out for hardworking taxpayers. And I went around the state. I put 50,000 miles on my car promising that I would look out for taxpayers and that we would do things differently and that we wouldn't make short-sighted financial decisions. We would do things in a fiscally responsible way. And to me, I'm just standing up, doing my job, and making sure that I deliver on the promises that I made to make sure that we think about the long term in these decisions. So that's what the treasurer does. You know, a former treasurer has a great way to define what this job is. He says, in the poker game between the legislature and the governor, the treasurer is the keeper of the chips. And our job is to make sure that the math adds up and the chips add up. And with this particular plan, the math is just bad. It just doesn't add up. And we've got to change the math.
Jeff, one final question for you. It has to go back again to your investment background, because you've talked a lot about long-term, and there are different kinds of investors out there. There are long-term investors. There are short-term investors. Do you think that state government can ever afford to be a short-term investor, or do we always have to look in the long-term?
No, I think, especially with this, because this is a trust in perpetuity. Again, this trust is meant to be here for our children, our children's children, their children. It's supposed to go on forever. And so basically, we're the ultimate long-term investor. And when you invest for the long term, you will see swings. We are going to see this account go down. The market does not always go up. We will see swings in this, and then later on down the road, it will be at all-time highs like it is now again, and even new highs. But we need to be ready for the fact this fund does not just go up. It does go down. And it's one of the other things that I've been talking about is all of the forecasts. When we talk about, oh, there'll be more money later, those are based around the fact that the market's going to keep going up. We've seen a big run in the market. It would seem logical that we're going to see at some point the market to correct itself or come back in line with where it could be. We will see negative returns, and we have to be ready to protect principal when that happens.
Arizona State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt. Jeff, thanks very much for your patience. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We just heard why State Treasurer DeWitt is not happy with Governor Ducey's proposal to provide more funding for K-12 education by increasing the amount of money that comes out of the state land trust to schools. Arizona Republic editorial columnist Bob Robb had a column today with his perspective on that. He's with me to talk about it. Bob, good morning.
Good to be with you.
So what are the main issues? What are the problems you have with what the treasurer has said?
His main point is that we can't dip into principal. In the first place, there's nothing in the Enabling Act which has that restriction. There's just a requirement that the proceeds from the state land trust be used to benefit schools. And even if you were to accept that as a line that you can't cross, the true principal in the trust are the land sales over the course of years. The current trust consists of a large amount of retained earnings that were never distributed. And so you could probably do Ducey's proposal and not get to the true principal. Additionally, to the extent that the Ducey proposal would dip into principal, it would be for a very modest amount for a very short period of time. And for the last 5 years, the rate of return on the trust has exceeded the 10% that Ducey would provide for the distribution from the trust to the schools for the next 5 years. But the most important one is that the schools are currently hurting. Ducey's proposal would get $350 million a year to the schools over this five-year period. That would get them back to approximately where they were in 2008 before the recession hit. There really is no realistic alternative to help schools to that amount in a meaningful sum over the next 5 years, except for a tax increase. Mm-hmm. And as you heard, the treasurer doesn't have – that is the logical implication of the position that he has taken. And as you could hear, he doesn't have the political fortitude to advocate it. So I think the realistic options for the state are either we continue to fund schools at our current level for a fairly for the interim period, mm-hmm. Or we go with the Ducey proposal. And given current financial circumstances, even if it requires temporarily and very modestly dipping into principal to help schools in these circumstances, I think that's the prudent and responsible thing for a trustee to do.
Bob, do you have a problem with DeWitt coming out and criticizing the plan and, in essence, as you said, not really wanting to discuss the idea of a tax increase or taking another step out of that? Are we in a situation where, whether it's Dean Martin, Carol Springer, whoever, to criticize the governor and not have some sort of alternative offering?
No, I mean, the impact on the fund compounded over time from increasing the distribution is real, and it's something that should be calculated into the decision as whether you go forward with the Ducey proposal. Mm-hmm. Now, I happen to think that the prudent and responsible thing is to use the fund or its intended beneficiaries at this fairly significant point of need when there's no practical alternative to getting the money in. But the state treasurer isn't a policymaker in that sense. And so I don't regard DeWitt as having engaged in the issue inappropriately. Mm-hmm. I think he's wrong on the substance. And politically, he has wittingly or unwittingly become the face of opposition to the governor's proposal. That's sort of an interesting political dynamic for fellow GOP state office holders. So I might question his political judgment. I think he's wrong on the substance. But there's nothing inappropriate with the state treasurer pointing out the long-term implications of what I think is a justifiable short-term response to a serious funding problem with our schools.
Now, are we going to have a broader debate about this issue, Bob, related to this? Because it seems like a great percentage of people agrees that the state does not put enough funding into K-12 education, but then the real disagreement comes about, well, how should it be spent? Is too much being spent on administrative costs? Do teachers get paid enough, et cetera? But is this going to lead us down that path, whether we agree with DeWitt or anyone else agrees with DeWitt or they agree with Ducey or whatnot, is this going to open up for a broader debate that in some ways maybe the state hasn't had at the legislature recently?
I don't think so. I think that the Ducey proposal is designed and intended as a bridge to get the schools in better shape financially while we're still in this post-recession sluggish growth in state revenues. And then we'll see where we are at the end of that period of time, whether state revenues pick up and the additional spending that the Ducey proposal would permit can be funded through other tax sources, or whether we need to address the issue of a tax increase. Simultaneously, Ducey does have a task force and an interest in looking at the way funds are currently expended. And I suspect we will see over the course of this year and the early part of next various proposals from the governor to change the way money is distributed and the way money is used. But one of the significant parts of the governor's proposal is that it's an admission that irrespective of what you do on those tracks, there needs to be more money in the bucket.
Well, right. And who's going to take, as you talk about political, using political capital, having political courage, a lot of people were surprised when Governor Brewer stepped out in support of the 3-year temporary sales tax increase. I guess I'm wondering here, Bob, is there a concern about having primary opponents, for example, for state lawmakers? Or is it really that this philosophy of raising taxes specifically for something like education, just the idea of raising taxes is just anathema?
Well, certainly there's a philosophical opposition to tax increases and a philosophical favoritism towards tax cuts that's deeply rooted within the Republican Party and particularly deeply rooted in the conservative members of the legislature and in our governor, Doug Ducey. But there's also an issue of what will state revenues do once they settle. If we get back to historic rates of growth in state revenues, then it produces tons of money and a lot of restorations can take place. And these additional proceeds from the state land trust can be replaced with ordinary tax revenues. But and the historic rate of growth is 6-8%. We currently seem to be stuck at 4%. If 4% is the new normal, then after this bridge that Ducey has proposed expires, you're going to be facing serious questions. And I think the issue of having a tax increase becomes more difficult to ignore or finesse.
Bob Robb, editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. Bob, stick with us for just a minute. I want to finish up this conversation after this break. Plus, we'll be talking about water problems in Detroit as we wrap up Here and Now. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on KJZZ.org and 91.5 FM. We'll see mostly sunny skies today in the valley, a high near 105 degrees, about the same for tomorrow, the high dropping to 104, and we've got a slight chance for some rain tomorrow evening. Partly sunny skies on Friday, it'll be 105 again then. Taking a look at valley traffic right now on I-10 eastbound, there's an accident blocking the Chandler Boulevard on-ramp, and on 59th Avenue in Glendale, that road is closed right now between Bell and Union Hills for an ongoing police investigation. Join us today at 12 for NPR's Here and Now. In the past 5 years, police misbehavior in Philadelphia has cost that city $50 million, and there's no end in sight. And a conversation with Education Secretary Arnie Duncan about new bills intended to revise No Child Left Behind. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 96 degrees at 11:51.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein with Arizona Republic editorial columnist Bob Robb. Bob, as we wrap up, I'm curious as to, now that Doug Ducey's been in office since January, do you think these kinds of things affect him in any way? Is he the type who stews about these little disagreements, or does he just sort of focus and go on?
A combination. I'm sure that DeWitt becoming the face of opposition to a signature proposal for him has to stick in his craw. I'm sure that there's a more than inconsiderate degree of unhappiness with the state treasurer in the governor's office and by the governor himself. But the governor does seem to take things in stride and to keep his bearings and his perspective and move forward. And the reality on the state land trust is that nobody has another option that gets a comparable amount of money to the schools in this time frame, except for a tax increase, which I think is not politically feasible currently.
And Bob, finally, we've had conversations in the past in general about the Diane Douglas, Doug Ducey back and forth, and now perhaps a Jeff DeWitt, Doug Ducey back and forth. Are there real legitimate battles going on within the Republican Party, or is it just that Arizona's at a time now where all the statewide elected officials are of one party, so it's inevitable there are going to be these little tit for tats?
I think a combination again, Steve. Ducey, in my judgment, got sucked in to the fights with Diane Douglas. He should have left that between the Board of Education and Diane Douglas. He didn't really have a dog in that fight. And so he became the face of opposition to Diane Douglas, and that obviously escalated the spat. So in that case, I think Ducey got engaged in a fight that he should have avoided and could have avoided. With respect to the state treasurer, I mean, you do have unusually a state lower officer challenging becoming the face of the opposition to a signature proposal for the governor. That's a fairly large political development, and I suspect it will have repercussions beyond this single issue. Now, I don't think it's likely that DeWitt represents some growing force of opposition within the Republican Party to the governor and his leadership, particularly in the legislature. That leadership has been welcomed and strongly supported. And there's just not that many issues on which the state treasurer can make himself relevant. So my suspicion that this is a one-off given the issue.
Arizona Republic editorial columnist Bob Robb. Bob, thanks as always.
Good to be with you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Here in Arizona, we're very focused on water, whether we'll have enough and where we'll find more if we need it or if we need to conserve more. Our neighbor to the west, California, has already implemented cutbacks to deal with the effects of drought. But water challenges are not entirely about rainfall and snowpack and nature. Nation contributor Laura Gottesdiener wrote the piece, Detroit is Ground Zero in the New Fight for Water Rights. She's also a producer for Democracy Now! Laura, thanks for fitting us in for a couple of minutes. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did the dramatic water shutdowns in Detroit start? How many people are affected so far?
Sure. So approximately 40,000 people were affected last year, and another 25,000 people are affected this year. They started the most recent rounds of the water shutoffs started around 2013 when the city of Detroit contracted a private company named Homrich Construction to begin a process of systematically cutting off the water from people who were behind on their bills. That might sound like a pretty reasonable policy, but when you take into account that at the time that they instituted that policy, half of all Detroit residents were behind on their water bills, it starts to become a serious public health and community-wide problem. So from there, in 2014, the city disconnected somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 residents' homes, their running water. Many of those homes later had their water restored. Some did not. I spoke to a woman who has been living for 6 or 7 months without running water on an extreme conservation of water program that would make California look pretty laughable. I mean, the problem broadly on the East Coast is that many, many cities have aging municipal water infrastructure and pretty poorly designed water billing systems such that they don't take into account residents' actual income. They simply say, this is how much you owe for water. And if you can't pay, you don't get any water. And the problem is that in cities like Detroit, Baltimore, but even places like Boston, an increasing number of residents are unable to pay their water costs.
So from a legal standpoint, based on what legal officials or judges have said, do people in Detroit or any other city have that right to water in some sense, whether or not they can pay their bills on time?
Right. That's essentially the big question right now, and that's why the Detroit situation is so interesting. So in 2014, when Detroit was under emergency management and being essentially governed by a bankruptcy judge, Judge Rhodes, the many community groups and residents who'd had their water shut off went to court to determine precisely that. They filed to have an emergency injunction put on the city's plan to try to halt temporarily the disconnection of water. And what the judge ruled in the fall of 2014 was that Detroit's residents did not have an enforceable right to water, that that right does not exist in the state constitution or the U.S. Constitution. California actually has taken a different tack. California has passed legislation that says that residents do have a right to water. And on the international level, the treaties, the international human rights treaties to which the United States is a partner, to which the United States has signed on to, say that residents do have the right to safe and affordable and clean water. So right now, essentially, places like Detroit and states and cities across the country are dealing with this jurisdictional and levels of human rights versus municipal rights. And what people in Detroit are trying to do and linking up with, you know, other water rights activists from across the country is pass legislation and enact legislation such that at the federal level, such that across the United States, people, all residents would have an enforceable right to water.
Laura, just time for one more question. But in the broader sense, are communities going to be willing to work together, or is it every city or state for itself? Here in Arizona, we've actually seen some major cooperation between Phoenix and Tucson, that if there are problems with water supplies in one city or the other, they'll try to work together on that. Are we going to have to see that kind of thing, or will, again, some cities, for lack of a better term, sort of hoard their own water because they've got it to hoard?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I certainly can't predict how cities and regions across the country are going to react to the growing scarcity crisis. I can certainly say that the reason that many believe that we need federal legislation to ensure the right to water access for all residents is because we have these dual problems right now. California, Arizona, you know, out west, you guys don't have enough water. People in Michigan, Michigan has 20% of the world's fresh water in the Great Lakes. So they're awash in water. And yet tens of thousands of residents at any given time in the city of Detroit either don't have water access at all or are facing imminent shutoff. So certainly regions across the country are going to need to work together as some regions run dry and other regions have plenty. But we're also going to need to see within cities and states, governments be willing to look at the disparate income levels of their residents and say, how do we actually charge for water such that we're charging a percentage based on people's real income rather than saying a fixed rate for everybody such that some can afford it easily and others can't afford it at all.
Laura Gottesdiener is a contributor to The Nation. Her piece is called Detroit is Ground Zero in the New Fight for Water Rights. She's also a producer for Democracy Now! Laura, thanks for the time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry, Bruce Drummond, Dave Atkins, and Chris Furfier for their help on today's program. And thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program, our conversation with State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt, it'll be online later this afternoon at kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by AZ Kebab House, located near Harkins 101 off of Mayo in Scottsdale, serving Chef Arif's authentic Persian dishes, fire-roasted gyros, chicken, beef, and lamb kebabs, fresh baklava, and tea. azkebab.com.